From the heart of Vermont, this podcast is brought to you by Capital City Concerts, a concert series which assembles exceptional musicians from across the globe in remarkable live performances in an intimate venue. Learn more at capitalcityconcerts.org.
I think secretly I always wanted to be discovered, right? Which is a long story and a great big lie that we don't ever get discovered. We work hard and we grow. We keep slogging. That was one of the central lessons I learned in my life is that we don't ever arrive. We just keep going.
My name is Karen Kevra, and you're listening to Muse Mentors, a podcast about artists and their mentors. Some people say it's not what you know, but who you know. I say it's how you know them. Karen McCadden is a poem. Her tuneful alto voice and her expressive way with words are gorgeous music in and of themselves. I've known Karen for more than three decades, and I still remember the day we met. It was 1989, and I was a staff member at the food co-op in the beautiful, funky, and counterculture-y village of Plainfield, Vermont. One fine summer day, Karen McCadden walked through the door. Clichés be damned, she was the essence of loveliness. I kid you not, she looked like a mythical maiden from an Irish legend. Perfect skin, gorgeous eyes, and long, flowing dark hair. I was just married, and she was about to marry. In fact, soon after we met, she asked me to play Celtic music at her wedding. So we were first young brides, then young mothers. And along the way, we had divorces and second marriages, plus we were both career late bloomers in our respective art forms. Karen McCadden has established herself as an outstanding American poet and did all of this while raising two extraordinary kids as a single mom while working full-time for nearly three decades as a beloved English teacher at Montpelier High School in the capital city of Vermont. In recent years, she's compiled an impressive list of accolades. She is a National Endowment for the Arts Fellow and has received the Sustainable Arts Foundation Writing Award, the Vermont Book Award, the New Issues Poetry Prize, and the Button Poetry Prize. Her poems have appeared in Best American Poetry and the Academy of American Poets Poem a Day series, American Poetry Review, New England Review, and many, many more. Her new collection of poems is made of the stuff of life. Subjects like family, divorce, raising children, love, and death are poignantly bound together by her strong Irish heritage and her family's immigrant story. The book is called American Wake. You will come to see that this is an extraordinary title with multiple layers of meaning. American Wake is an actual term, and I wasn't familiar with it until I became acquainted with Karen McCadden's poems. American Wake refers to a kind of Irish wake-style farewell party. The Irish would throw these parties for families before they set sail for America. There are a few lines from the title poem American Wake that define the concept in a poetic nutshell. Hold a wake for the living, the leaving. Stop the clocks and turn the mirrors. Tell stories, smoke and eat and drink. It was never a question of whether they'd leave, but when. I'm struck by the amount of scholarship, research, travel, and deeply personal stories that go into Karen's poems. A lot of us dabble in ancestry and build family trees, but Karen has made it a way of life. The rich subject of heritage was front and center when we spoke recently. It's become my habit on Muse Mentors to ask my guests to take me back to their childhood because family and a sense of place matters so much. But you, Karen McCadden, have an unusually deep family connection that reaches back quite a bit in time and even across the pond to your Irish ancestors. So I'd love for you to tell me about your family.
I grew up in Lexington, Massachusetts, and my father's parents lived in Somerville, which was about not 20 minutes away, and they were from Ireland. They had come over when they were 20 years old in 1920. They had known each other as children in Donegal and met at a dance in Everett, Massachusetts, and then got married and raised their children in Somerville. And my dad and my mom, you know, when they met, they moved to Lexington. But we were always seeing them for Sunday dinners and they'd come for holidays. And they were a really big part of my childhood.
How did they travel to the U.S.?
They came on boats. My grandmother came on the Aquitania. It was a big, beautiful ship. And I don't know how my grandfather came. Apparently, he came illegally. Something about going back and forth through Canada. And then he was riding the trains for a while. So that's a little bit of family lore that I can't fact check.
Yeah. Well, something that really draws me to your poetry is that family legacy is so strong for you as it is for me on my mom's side of the family, which was the side of my family that I really grew up with and came to know. They came from the Middle East, from Egypt and Lebanon. And I did some ancestral sleuthing like you have done and was able to unearth a ship manifest one day. And it was so exciting to see all these names of great aunts and uncles and all of the little boxes that had to be checked off about their health and whether or not they were socialists or anarchists. It was really, really remarkable. So this seems like a good time for you to read your poem, American Wake. I wonder if you could give us a little bit of the backstory and then read it for us.
Sure. An American Wake was a tradition that both of my grandparents would have gone through when they were leaving to come for the United States. And the way it worked was that the people in the community, the family and the neighbors and the people in the townland would get together to hold a wake for the young person who was leaving, just like they would have if the person had died. So it was a way to sort of consecrate and bless the passage of the person across the ocean, but also it was acknowledging that they would never see this person again because the ocean, I mean, this is way before air travel. So the ocean was like a kind of symbolic loss, right? If you went across the ocean, you couldn't come back. So they would spend all night long, as the Irish do, celebrating and crying over the newly, quote, dead one. It really strikes me as incredibly, I don't know, traumatic, stirring, and beautiful that a young person would experience their own wake.
It sounds a little bit macabre.
Totally.
But also joyful. And
as with everything I've come to see in Ireland, there's a mixture of the sacred and the macabre and humor all mixed together. This poem starts with a little epigraph, which is a song that was sung in Donegal. And the lines go, "The land is too small to serve all, and we must cross the sea." I'll begin the poem. American Wake. Hold a wake for the living, the leaving. Stop the clocks and turn the mirrors. Tell stories. Smoke and eat and drink. It was never a question of whether they'd leave, but when. Play games to pass the time. Not to check that the dead are dead, but to lift a lesser god. Tell what you've heard about the new world. Later, all you will be able to tell is what you remember. Let the keener loose on the night. Let the house wail. Sing the songs. Let pipes keep evil at bay. Square off with your child and dance. Let the neighbors whose baby was born with a call lend it. A charm against drowning. Give dry cakes for the passage, a box of eggs. Roast frogs, grind them to a powder, and bake into bread to safeguard against fever. Take no shortcuts to the dock. This is it. The bees will tell the other world who's gone.
Have you had roasted frog bread before?
No, I found out about it by researching. I'd never heard of this before. There's very little information about American wakes on the internet, but I did find that. I was like, holy crap, that's so weird.
Yeah, you are quite the researcher. That's great. It strikes me that your poem, In the Harbor, is your own present day American Wake moment. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how that relates to American Wake and then read that poem.
This poem comes from, it's inspired by an illustration of people standing in the ocean waving goodbye to a ship as it was leaving to bring loved ones to America from Ireland. So it's this beautiful moment of people so eager to stay in the moment of saying goodbye that they're in the ocean up to their hips waving, this sort of desperate trying to get closer to who's going away. And I was thinking about how easy it is for me to go back and forth across the ocean now. Just like, oh, I'm going to get in a plane, going to go to Ireland for 3 to 5 weeks, and then I'll come back home again. So I just was thinking about the juxtaposition of the ease of my life and the difficulty of my grandparents' generation. In the harbor. I love the moment after buckling the seatbelt in a plane headed God knows where, anywhere. How I know there is no way to do laundry, dishes, or fix a leak, everything all get back behind me on the ground once I've lifted off, which I think is almost, but also nothing like that moment after the Aquitania has started moving, but first the smaller boat in the harbor, which maybe I am on with them when time happens again, starts to move out to sea. Last night, we drank all night like I was the new dead one. The stories told again and again like prayers. When we are out to sea, we look back to see faces ringing the shore like a fence. Those we love in up to their hips in waves, waving goodbye like mad.
Well, thank you. I was looking at photographs of the Aquitania today. The boat that my grandmother came on was not such a nice boat. They were definitely steerage passengers.
So
it was pretty
mine.
Rough. Oh, really? Oh, it looked like a really nice boat.
No. We had nothing. You know, they left because of poverty, and I know that they were steerage passengers.
Mm. Another one of your ancestral poems is called Seal Bride. I couldn't help but wonder if this was your own take on a Selkie story.
Yeah. And it's interesting talking about mentors and origin stories at the same time. This poem is a response to a poem, Diving into the Wreck by Adrienne Rich. And it's one of the first poems I ever read in college that just blew my mind in terms of its depth and its beauty and its structure and what it was accomplishing. So this poem is definitely talking back to that poem. My book talks about divorce and going back to Ireland and heritage and family, and the idea of the Selkie gaining back herself in many ways for me was a poem about post-divorce life, but also going back to Ireland as a seal just felt like really a lovely place for my imagination to go.
And for those who don't know what a Selkie is.
Oh, well, it's a mythical creature that she's a woman who's also a seal. And if you steal her skin when she takes it off, you get to keep her for some amount of time, and then she can be free once she gets her skin back, something like that. Do you want me to read it?
I would love it.
Okay. Seal Bride. Having stolen back my skin, I lub across rocks, slip into water, my closable nostrils, my closable ears. No one can tell me what to do here. I welter and lumber in all directions, fusiform, my flippers like wings. I may be a fallen angel, or my brother may be, I don't know. First I am thinking, and then I am not. First I am remembering, and then I am eating a fish, my sharp teeth mine. Below, veins of telecommunications cable I have no need for. No emails of mine going anywhere anymore. A few may be trying to find me. I go down. Above the sky, a shiny toy, a building set of tinsel and sequins knocked down through the sea. I can go anywhere, push away with my hind flippers, and press my nose forward, skyward, corkscrewward. You know what I will say next. It is easy to forget why I came here. It is easy to forget why I left, the phone cord ripped from the wall, my body not mine. There were so many ways to divide by 7. Which year would be my last there? The mountain air was a liar. The swallows were liars too. They came back. They came back. They played in the sky. They dove. They sat on wires, built nests on the porch lights, said with mud and straw, "This is home." I believed them, the flying fish of them, their iridescence, the way they knew the sky. This is not that place. I am alone and not alone here, free. Sometimes the water is a hollow, nothing to see but seagrass waving and one white fish. So vast I am granular, a speck, a nothing. And sometimes there is everything, clouds of fish, threats threading past. I may never find any way to love, and I may not find any way to love. I may, among the wrecked ships, the rusted husks and split cable, find that I am the broken dinnerware, the linens, my dead friends sent back to find me in the half-light. Monsters and shipwrecks, monsters and shipwrecks. I put my nose to submarine cables reaching across the Atlantic and whisker confessions out of them. Answers as inscrutable as the stars on the whale shark's back, her mouth a cave I almost can't resist.
I love the undersea technology references. For some reason, I don't know why, lately I've been thinking about what it would be like to be a creature living in the ocean with a lot of human stuff.
Yeah.
In my midst.
It's funny you should pick up on that, because sometimes I think things get into poems, like you do all this research and you may not put the research into the poem, but somehow someone can feel it. You know, I spent a lot of time looking at maps of undersea cables when I was writing this poem. Like the names of the cables and which line goes to which country. It's quite a powerful thing to look at, to realize how much undersea cable is on the floor of the ocean.
Yeah, so you still have me thinking about heritage. And, you know, growing up in the 70s and 80s, I remember conversations in the various school cafeterias where I would be talking with my classmates, and unfailingly the question would come up, what nationality are you?
Right.
But I don't think people ask this question anymore. And I think, sadly, it's maybe become a touchy subject. Maybe it's not PC to ask that question. It's as though it's crossing a kind of ethnic boundary that's not okay. I mean, even in the last 10 or 20 years, I used to frequently ask my students, you know, someone would come in with beautiful green eyes and red hair, and I would ask the question, you know, what nationality are you? Where are your ancestors from? And they would often just blink at me or say, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Do you think we've lost something there?
Well, I think every generation you get farther away from immigration, you lose that sense of identity anyway, because you are then just American, right? That's, I think, what happens. That, like, if your family is from Ireland three generations ago, you don't think about it as much as if it's part of your personal recent narrative. You know, my grandparents, and knowing about their life in Ireland, I knew very little about their lives there, but just knowing that that was their origin made me feel like it was also mine. But I have friends whose ancestry goes farther back, and it's less, maybe less present to them. It's an interesting question.
Well, I think also, you know, when I was a kid, I thought my grandparents weren't very cool. I thought they were pretty unremarkable. And now I think, you know, there they were, you know, my grandmother getting on a ship in Alexandria, Egypt, and sailing from there to Paris, and then from Paris to New York, and eventually having an arranged marriage with my grandfather from Lebanon and making a life together. And my grandfather was a farmer, and he got this idea, which to me now sounds like the most hipster thing one could do. He decided to grow specialty vegetables for the Middle Eastern market, things that you couldn't get here otherwise, that he had brought seeds back, and he would grow them, and they would truck them into New York. They would go to Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn to a place that still exists called Sahadi's. And he was one of their produce suppliers there.
That's so interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
I want to go back to that question you asked about people who maybe don't identify with their heritage. My grandparents didn't want me to identify as Irish. They didn't want to talk about it. So like your grandfather brought vegetables over and kind of kept that going, that sort of the ethnic food train going, you know?
I think he just didn't know what else to do. That was the thing that he knew and figured, I'd better find a way to work.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. My grandfather was a longshoreman and a rigger on the docks of Boston, but they wouldn't talk to me about where they were from. We knew very little about Ireland itself, and they did not encourage us at all to find our family over there. So my grandparents didn't want us to identify as Irish. They wanted us to be Americans. You know, they had sacrificed so much to come here. And so my questions about where we were from and what was it like were always answered with requests for me to stop talking. You know, like they would say, wished your brother, because I wasn't supposed to be so, you know, quizzical about where they came from. And
what does that mean?
Wished means be quiet, and your blether means your blather. So quiet your blather. Huh. You know, stop talking, little girl. You know, I just wanted to know. And all I really knew was that my grandfather had a dirt floor and my grandmother did not. But they lived in these very small houses. And
did they speak English?
Yeah, they did. I don't even know if they spoke Irish. I really don't know.
My grandparents definitely spoke Arabic. Mm-hmm. You know, frequently, and yet we weren't encouraged to learn it. You know, there were certain words that we picked up. You know, one of the things I heard all the time was yalla yalla, which meant, you know, hurry up or out of my way or you're bothering me. It was kind of an all-purpose word, and you know, names for vegetables and foods, and also curse words. Those seem to come through. But you're right, there was this sense of let's embrace being Americans and go on from there.
And then move out to the suburbs and raise your family generation by generation. I still, you know, our family has this thing. My father says every generation we need to get more educated than the last one. So he had a bachelor's degree. I had to get a master's. My daughter's working on her PhD. Like it's kind of like, it's got a sense of humor to it, but this notion that they sacrifice so much to come here. And not only will we assimilate into this culture, we'll get as much education as we can.
Yeah. And yet they were the brave ones. I think about all that they gave up and, you know, the risks leaving and traveling, and it was no picnic being aboard these ships and then arriving and being faced with racism and having to start a whole new life when you didn't really speak the language. They really sacrificed a lot. It was quite amazing. You know, while I went to Girl Scouts and practiced my flute.
Right. I took ice skating lessons and went to Girl Scouts. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, were you a very young poet?
I was always a really imaginative kid and always faulted for daydreaming. I was always daydreaming. Whenever there was an opportunity to write anything creative in school, I always took it and was always delighted. I wouldn't say that I thought of myself as a poet, though. I just liked doing things that were fun. I liked art. I liked drawing. I liked being creative and imaginative. I have found like some very funny vestiges of my early life as a poet.
Ah, do you have any of them nearby?
It would take me a second. I found it.
Great.
Okay. Here's a poem I wrote when I was in, I don't know, maybe third grade. A poodle is like a curly white doodle. A clock is like a dirty gray sock. A girl is like a silvery pearl. A boy is like a banged up rusty old toy. The number 7 is like the golden heavens. A good time is like a lime villain's crime. Just think, it's so, that last line, I'm just like, what the heck? A good time is like a lime villain's crime. And I think this was one of those exercises where we were learning what a simile was. Why else would it be a list of what's like what else? My mother saved that and sent it to me not long ago. And I was like, oh my God, too fun.
That is so great. So what ultimately drew you to poetry?
When I was in high school, I was a bad student. I didn't want to read another book by Ernest Hemingway. Or really what I was discovering was I was losing patience with literature by dead white men. And I wanted things to feel relevant to me. my mom knew I liked poetry, and she went to a church sale and came back with an anthology of beat poetry. So Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso,
Ferengetti.
Yeah, all of them. It's just the collection was called The New American Poets, 1945 to 1960. I still have it. It's held together with rubber bands. I highlighted everything that I thought was beautiful in the book. Like, I just spent time touching it with a highlighter. I was so excited by the strange language and strange uses of language. And I remember feeling like, oh, the meaning isn't just in the words, it's in the space between the words, like the juxtapositions and the tensions between images that would make you spark an idea in your mind as a reader. And I felt like I had found something magical and I wanted to do it.
That's like music. You know, we often say it's the space between the notes where the music resides.
Oh, that's fascinating. And I also think a lot about musicality when I write.
And it shows.
Thank you. When I'm writing, I don't always think consciously like, oh, I need this sound to be here, but I feel it. Like I reach for things because I can feel that the music comes with this word, not that word.
I found that to be the case in the one that you wrote about your ex's cell phone ringtone. And it was the most incredibly musical poem. I felt a sense of rhythm and it was jarring and it also made me laugh aloud. Which poem is that one?
It's called Objects in Mirror Are Closer Than They Appear.
Ah. Is that one you'd want to read?
Oh, sure. That's, you know, it's funny. There are poems that are just really fun to read and poems that are serious and, you know, you make different kinds of space for, but I really do enjoy reading this one. So I'm happy to do that. So I think about form either before I write a poem or after I'm done. What form does this expression want to take? And this one is, I think of it as like a plank, like a bunch of things thrown together on a piece of wood that are held together by some kind of invisible system of rubber bands. The poem is allowed to go where it wants to go. There are no stanza breaks, so the poem pulls you through it also. So that's sort of, I like this form when I know that there's a subject that's pretty fraught, you know, just to see what happens. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But this is about divorce and that space of trying to build your own life as a single parent in your own home while you realize you're getting older. You know, that there's a lot of tension in that situation. So I appreciated letting the poem have its tension too. Objects in mirror are closer than they appear. And what isn't closer than you thought? Start with bills, so sweet over the transom, with the polite origami of their envelopes, as if inviting you out of the house, out of doors, away from your infernal typing. Come, visit. Until they come again and again, closer and closer, like texts from an ex-husband that you have cleverly given his own ringtone, the science fiction one, so that every time he wants something, he breaks into your village home like a flying saucer landing on Earth. So close, all of a sudden, the peace and quiet you have built shattered. And there he is, ray gun brandished, demanding, what time, how much, why not, why don't you ever, if you would only, I need to know these things, if you want any money, you have to maintain the spreadsheet, blaster, phaser, rocket grenade, the phone lighting up at night with him, lasers blasting the bedroom blue. He is suddenly closer than he appears, so all you want, since the first one feels so small behind you, is another divorce, a bigger one, like a shield. Anger behind you, after all, is closer than it appears, and never stops following like a small dog worrying the insides of his thighs with small teeth while you try to sleep. The skateboarders at night clack, clack, clacking down the sidewalk outside the window, louder than they should be in the village night, when all else is still, or should be, leaving you to dream of your daughter, who has gotten smaller, farther away, sleeping in a dorm like a barracks amid piles of impossible textbooks and labs, the first few weeks bigger than you thought when you stared down the barrel of time until she left, for real, gone away what could be forever, which is a really long time, considering what the mirror says, whichever one is kinder, under the light of which sun you have organized above it. your face held there in various lights, you smiling, because that is what to do in a mirror, smile in greeting, as if you don't know yourself, the sincere greeting for passers-by, the hello of myself, bigger than I know, smiling at others, the lines of my eyes deepening so that I offer bird feet in greeting, the tufted spines of my plumage, gray, growing downy, my neck bowed more than I know, leaning studiously toward you as if I care, not as if now that is how it goes, bent, looking closer into the mirror than I care to.
That's wonderful. It's got everything. So how did you come to Vermont?
I came to Vermont to go to St. Michael's College, where I studied English and contemporary poetry with an amazing English department.
And when was that?
That was in 1984 to 1988. I knew I loved poetry and I wanted to study it. And I was in college and I was just so excited by what I was reading. I started trying to write, but we didn't have any programs in creative writing in the late 80s that I knew of. So I was just trying to figure it out on my own and figured it out pretty badly.
I'll be back with my guest, Karen McCann, in just a moment. Karen McCadden's newest poetry collection, American Wake, is available pretty much anywhere books are sold, online or in person, but I'd like to suggest that you order directly from Karen's hometown Vermont bookstore, Phoenix Books. They have stores in Essex, Burlington, and Rutland, Vermont, or you can find them online at phoenixbooks.biz. As a musician, one of the things that strikes me about Karen McCadden's poems is the musicality. She pays close attention to the words she chooses, the levels of sound, rhythm, sentence structure, even the texture of words, and you hear that musicality in the way she reads her poems. A poet who writes beautiful poems and reads them so beautifully is a rare thing. Karen McCadden's two most important mentors were both musicians, so it's no wonder that the music comes through in Karen's poems. David Budbill was Karen's first mentor. He was a beloved Vermont poet who died in 2016 and who gained a national reputation in part thanks to Garrison Keillor regularly including David's poems on his Writer's Almanac segment on NPR. Ellen Bryant Voigt, who was a Pulitzer and National Book Award finalist and the Poet Laureate of Vermont, also helped Karen to find her way as a poet, first at Middlebury College's Breadloaf Writers Conference, and later on when Karen followed Ellen to the MFA program at Warren Wilson College.
So I was a young teacher, and I was losing my patience with professional development. And I asked my district, I said, can I just use the money to pay a writer to work with me? And they said, yes. So I wrote David Budbill a letter and I asked him if he would work with me for a semester. And he said, yes. Mm-hmm. And it was just like a door in the sky opening. Like, what? He said, yes. And he said, I will work with you if you give me every shred of poetry you've ever written. I don't care if it's garbage. I don't care if it's like the beginning of a thought, I want you to give me everything. And it was horrifying, you know, because I, as I said earlier, like I was a terrible poet and I was just really wanted to do it. And I loved how I felt when I was writing and I wanted to be a great poet. I think secretly I always wanted to be discovered, right? Which is a long story and a great big lie that we don't ever get discovered. We work hard and we grow, you know, and we keep slogging. That was one of the central lessons I learned in my life is that we don't ever arrive. We just keep going. But he was willing to look at all this work. And so I sent him this god-awful packet of poetry. I think it was 50 pages long. And he said, I'm taking a train from New York City to Vermont, and I will read it on the train. All I could do was picture this poor man reading all this garbage on the train. So the plan was that I was to go to his house, and we'd sit in his office and drink tea and talk about what I had written that week or that couple weeks. And he would talk to me about it and tell me what he thought. And he was patient and kind and pointed. And I learned some incredible lessons from him. He has this philosophy that every poem that anyone writes should be understandable by the bus driver and loved by the bus driver. The bus driver must be able to understand the poems we write. He really wants poems to be for everybody and not be tied up in some white tower somewhere. You know, they need to be for the people. And so I was writing these poems. I loved the modernists. I loved the early 20th century experimental poetry. Thought it was so cool. And I was trying to write like that. He's like, what are you even talking about? And I was like, well, these are a lot of images. I really like images. So David made me write poems that were explicitly clear. And they also were terrible, but they did make me week after week wrestle with my own life and tell stories in a way that someone else could understand them.
What makes a terrible poem?
For me, oh gosh, I think when they're unpracticed or when they're too on the nose or so far from being on the nose that you can't understand what they're saying. I think I was tying up knots of language in the earlier poems. I just wanted to make these strange little sculptures of words. And they were so satisfying to me. That lesson he taught me about work being accessible is something I've never stopped returning to. Like, I've never stopped caring about whether someone can understand what I'm saying. The other thing that I loved about working with David, I mean, just beyond how lovely he was and his home was beautiful, and he was just such an earnest human being. So one of the things that I appreciated about working with David was that when I was done working with him, I had unlearned something. Like, I went to him hoping to be validated and discovered and like told I was doing a good job, which was, I think every artist or everyone who's aspiring to be an artist wants that. Like, they want to like, am I doing it? Am I doing the thing? And he told me essentially, no, Karen, you're not doing the thing. You have a lot to learn. And yet I left his tutelage feeling like I had learned something really important. I love when you work with somebody and you go to them thinking that you know something and you leave knowing that you didn't know anything, but now you know something new and you have a direction you can take. You know, we never stayed close afterward. You know, I think I would write to him periodically, but we were not friends. It was kind of a bounded period of time, but I definitely carry him with me all the time.
It's hard for me to imagine what it's even like where you would start studying poetry. You know, as a musician, you are actually encouraged to mimic.
Yeah.
To some degree, to play like your teacher. And yes, we all want to have our special and unique voices. But, you know, when we're studying repertoire that's centuries old and there's a particular way to play it, we are trying to sound more or less the same. There's a convention there. I would think that one of the things you would want to be careful about is to not try to sound
right
like another poet. But, you know, how do you find your own voice?
Well, it's interesting. Like, the scariest thing about being a poet is you never want to be derivative. That's the word we throw around. And you don't want to be derivative of another poet. You don't want it to be so obvious that you came through them that that's part of who you are. And then you don't want to be derivative of yourself either. Like, you want to always be recreating and doing something somewhat new. There's a lot of pressure toward invention in poetry and change and reinvention of the self and the style. How do you find your own voice? I think it's through appetite. You know, like, you have a hunger to use language and be yourself and also lean on the masters and also learn from them, maybe just always pushing into all of those avenues at once.
Your brother died of a drug overdose in 2018, but I know he was a subject in your poems prior to that, and that you even prophetically wrote about his death. You published a chapbook called Keep This to Yourself last year, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about how this book came together, and also hearkening back to family again, a little more about your relationship with your brother.
Sure. So one of the things I was doing for years, like, there's a poem about my brother's addiction in my first book too, was sort of auditioning myself to be ready for the experience of losing him. Just because you never know. And when you live with someone who's living with addiction, you just simply don't know. It's like cancer. Will they survive it or will they not? It's an illness, you know, and I don't think I always understood that. So I was always writing poems to try to process the tentativeness of his life. The poem I wrote, When My Brother Dies, is a poem that I wrote long before he died. You know, when I read it now, it just sounds like I already know, but it was written years and years before we lost him.
Had he read it?
No, he didn't. I don't think he paid much attention to my work as a writer. So then when I lost him, I wrote a ton of poems really fast. It was how I had to process it. And so the second half of the book, you know, not first chronologically, first, second, but like the first clump of poems were about half the book and I had already written them. And then after I lost him, the poems just kept coming. And one night I it sounds so cheap, but I saw that there was this chapbook prize coming. And I thought, well, I wonder if there is a book of these poems. I wonder if they hold together. I wonder if this would be a powerful way to honor him, but also to show other people, to sort of let people into how difficult these losses are, and maybe do some good out of something that was just, it just felt like a senseless loss. And I thought, well, maybe if other people could read about it, they would either understand or build a layer of empathy they didn't have before, or maybe it would help them with their own family members in some way. Not that I think I'm incredibly wise about it, but I think I was really honest about it. We gravitate toward the difficult to try to process it. I don't know if we're always processing it for ourselves. I think sometimes we're doing it like a journalist. Like, here are these feelings and here's one way they can work. Yeah. I feel like I have to write about things I experience that are difficult because that's my car crash. Like, a journalist can't ethically drive past a car crash. They have to stop, you know, and report on it. And I feel like this was my reported.
There's a poem in that collection that's called Ashes. And I found it particularly interesting. There's a backstory there, again, about your Irish heritage. So I wonder if you could set us up for that poem before you read it.
So the summer before, I brought my brother's ashes to Ireland. Not all of them, some of them. We had always known that he was Irish and French Canadian. That was one thing we knew about his background, but we didn't know anything else about who his family had been or anything since he was adopted. After he died, his birth sister found us. So he had a sister from his mom, his birth mother.
She came looking for you at that point?
Came looking for him. He had left a note in his adoption file that if anyone came looking for him, he was okay with being contacted. And then she finally decided to try to look for people and missed him, tragically. But she's a part of our lives now. So it's funny. I always look at her and because she looks like my brother, it feels to me like she's my sister. You know, it's very strange to discover a sibling of an adopted sibling and feel a sibling tie to them. Mm. And so she came along and she gave me his birth mother's birth certificate. I was able to do his family tree. Which it was just like, I love heritage and family history and research and things like that. I love history. And it felt so tragic and so sad to do my brother's genealogical family tree after he was gone. I couldn't tell him about it. You know, I just couldn't share it with him. And so I decided that when I went to Ireland, I go to Ireland a lot now that I know where my family's from and I found my cousins there. And I researched in Ireland as far back as I could, like, where is the family of his that goes back the farthest? And I made it back to, I think, the 1700s.
Wow.
Which is rare in Ireland, right? To be able to go back that far. His family was from Portlaoise. I was through a Facebook group, a heritage group in Portlaoise. I just sent a message. I would like to find an old graveyard to bring my brother's ashes. And this woman got back to me right away and she says, I've got you. I'll meet you tomorrow morning. And so she unlocked the secret graveyard that she wasn't supposed to have access to so I could put my brother's ashes in the oldest graveyard in town. Mm. It was just a beautiful day and very moving. So that's the story behind it. Do you want me to read it?
Yeah. And before you do, I know there's a reference to Rory O'Moore. which I think that anybody who's had even pretty minimal contact with things Irish has heard the name Rory O'Moore, but maybe you can remind us who Rory O'Moore was.
Yeah. And so I'm not going to have a lot of details, but what I do know is he's in the cemetery. They had just cleared all the ivy off of a blank institutional wall where an old church had been. And people had painted a gorgeous mural of Rory O'Gomore and his woman, Margaret O'Byrne, and their wolfhounds. Rory O'Moore was fostered by another clan. So there was this whole tradition in Irish clans of fostering children. Like, you would have a child and send it to live with a neighboring clan to be raised, and then you'd get the child back. And it was a way of connecting clans to each other and creating ties. But it's an interesting story. And I remember that day she was telling me about this and saying, because I had told her about my brother, and she says, oh my, here's almost a saint in Irish history who's guarding this place where you're going to lay your brother, who was also adopted. You know, it just had this sort of beautiful iconography tied to it for me that day.
Yeah, that's amazing synchronicity. How wonderful. Yeah,
it just felt lovely and perfect.
I found a couple of photographs of that graveyard, and I'll make sure they're up on the Muse Mentors website. Well, would you like to read it?
I'm ready. Yeah. Ashes. After he is gone, his birth sister calls, finally thinking she has found her brother, too late to meet him for the first time. I can see his face in hers, his sweetness, as if I have always known her, as if she is my sister too. She brings his birth mother's name and birth certificate, what he had never known, names and dates, keys to his past, and I spend the summer hunting for where he came from, ancestor by ancestor, as if they could do anything to make amends. I search as far as I can until records disappear, to find a place to lay his ashes, to bring him home. I want to find his coordinates. Everything unbelievable happens, locks open. I promise to keep secrets. I stand in old St. Peter's graveyard under the church tower, in a pocket of graves walled inside the city, under a brand new mural of warrior Rory Og O'Moore and Margaret O'Byrne and their wolfhounds breaking into the day. The painted giant and his wife standing watch over the unmarked graves of Port Leash and over me, holding my brother in my hand. A light rain falls, and the woman who secretly lets me in waits out on the sidewalk, telling me to take my time. Here is where my brother's dead must be, or here is the ground where his people gathered for centuries, or here is a horse chestnut tree that has to be 400 years old, that his people must have seen. So there I stand with him, telling him he is home. I let his ashes fall through the ivy growing up the largest tree. Because we never know what to do, because I will never see him again, I fill my raincoat pocket with the tree's conkers. In the game of conkers, children thread them on strings and take turns swinging them, trying to break the other's conker. A game we would have played if we could have, if these trees had grown near us growing up. A conker that has never beat another is a nunner. If two nunners compete and one breaks the other, it's called a wunner. I'll keep going up the country to Donegal, to the bridge over the river at the crossroads to Mina Dreen. And after a week of carrying the rest of the ashes back and forth into the mountains, we'll put half on one side of the bridge where the water eddies peacefully, and half on the other side where it falls over rocks, through to rhododendrons, into a tiny cave of a valley, and pools there secretly, visited only ever by my family, the only ones who know it's there, until I'm finished dividing my brother into halves before my flight home.
I love the way that the tree, this gigantic 400-year-old tree, is kind of a focal point. It seems like trees are showing up more and more as characters in stories and poems. I think of Richard Powers, The Overstory.
That's on my reading list for this summer.
I am forever thinking about trees that span generations and centuries and have seen families emerge, have seen babies grow up and turn into grandfathers and die. And, you know, you think about it, especially a tree there in a graveyard, everything that it's seen is incredible. And then, of course, the Rory O'Moore reference, it's very powerful.
Thanks. You know, another thing, just to, while you're mentioning trees, in front of my great-grandparents' home on my grandfather's farm in Donegal, the house is a ruin. My cousin lives next to it in a newer home, but the ruin is still there. And right in front of it is a stand of hawthorn trees. And I started to notice that in front of so many of the ruined homes in Ireland, you'll see hawthorns. And they have this kind of magical quality. They have, if you look up the mythology of them, they are protectors and charms. And I think you can poison people with them. They're just these really powerful trees in the lore of Ireland. And I just think it's interesting. You're mentioning the power of trees, that tree is so powerful that people even recently have rerouted roads so that it won't go through. They won't move a hawthorn.
Good for them.
Yeah. You can't mess with the hawthorns.
I'll be back with my guest, Karen McCallum, in a moment.
You know, I had no idea if we had any family in Ireland, and my grandparents passed away. And after I was 18, they were gone. And I was like, gosh, I wonder, we've got to have family over there. Like, but there seemed to be no way to figure it out or that I could figure out. And then the internet was invented, right? So you could do searches. And of course, almost everybody with my last name is a relative of mine. Mm. So I found a cousin over there who was a genealogy nut. He actually ended up running the Irish Records Division for Ancestry.
That's convenient.
Yeah, in his grown-up years. But when we were kids, I think I was in my 20s, and he came over, my early 30s. He came to visit with his cousin, and eventually she invited me, and my circumstances became such that I could feel free enough to leave and go to Ireland and bring my family and meet whoever was there. She invited us to her wedding over there. That's how I first met my father's first cousin, who's still on the farm. And it makes me so happy just to have finally, you know, was stubborn enough to finally figure it out. So here's this poem, Our House Behind the Hawthorns. Up the lane, each house abandoned longer ago is deeper in bog moss and lichen. Our house is just stone walls, a box filled with rusted bed frames and plows. 11 children, 2 benches, a plank table, work and hall, kettle and hook, stick broom, dirt floor, turf light. At night, tiptoe the edges of 13 people sleeping. Come morning, the clouds are what moves, the magpie flashing like it is not afraid. The sheep say their words with their heads low, as if they know a story is a sacrament. What I came to learn, boxes have ways of folding that children can't know. The man I called, oh goodness sakes, would tell me nothing, signed the short song of his name with an X.
Tell me about the man, oh goodness sakes.
That's my grampy.
Okay.
when I was a kid and I'd go to visit him in Somerville, he'd open the door and he'd say, oh, for goodness sakes, would you look who's here? I turned that into his name. I called him, oh goodness sakes. Hi, oh goodness sakes.
Huh.
Yeah.
My grandfather was also illiterate and signed with an X.
Yeah. That's such a powerful thing to realize, right? Mm. You look at old documents and you see these X's and you're like, wait, that means they couldn't write. So my grandfather had a first grade education.
Yeah, mine didn't even have that, but
yeah,
boy, could he grow tomatoes. I wanted to circle back to your teaching.
Mm-hmm.
You have taught a course called poetry at Montpelier High School. Is that right?
Yeah. So I was teaching a class. It was a semester long called Creative Writing, Poetry. And then the next semester I would do prose. And we would read only contemporary poetry together, like stuff that was written within the past 10 years, because students were really excited by what writers were doing right now. It's a very exciting time for poetry, really powerful work that takes on social power constructs and identity and asserting whose place is whose in society. I find it a great loss that all high schools don't read contemporary poetry with kids on the regular basis, because kids love it. And what we did with it, we'd read a poem and talk about it, but we would talk about it not for analysis, but for construction. How did this poet build this poem? What are the pieces? How do you imagine they wrote it? And so we would kind of guess how they built it, like you would guess how a house was built.
The architecture of a poem.
Yeah. And then we would try to build our own. Like, okay, well, what tools is this person using? What do we call that? Oh, that's this. What if we tried that? And so it was a lot of experimentation and a lot of close looking at really exciting work. It was a lot of fun.
I asked you the question about what's it like to read the poetry of a 15-year-old, because unlike the world of music, where people are thrilled by or curious or somehow entertained by very young performers, I think there's always been a kind of youth cult in classical music. And I know there are exceptions, but it seems to me that poetry is so much deeper and more interesting when it comes from a person who's been writing for a while, from someone who's lived and loved and lost.
Right.
That's not something you're going to get from a young person. And yet, Amanda Gorman.
Right. And I also think that when students feel safe, they can write about stuff that they'll let things out that you might not know about them. And a lot of young people hold trauma. That's what they're living with. If you can teach them a way to express it, that's also art making, really powerful work can come out, especially if they're like, oh, this writer did this. I think I could find a way to do that with my material. I've had some young writers just write extraordinary work, just extraordinary. Like, and I even had one year, I had a girl who published in an adult journal. She just sent these. I was like, these are amazing. Send them out. And she did. And then she was invited to come read for the launch of the journal. And she flew to California.
Wow.
And showed up for the launch for 14 Hills, this wonderful journal. And they looked at her and they said, "You're a kid." She said, "Yes, I am."
So they didn't know. How wonderful.
I have worked with teenagers who have written work that could blow the socks off of editors at journals. You have students who came from Bosnia who learned how to write about their experience. Like, I think it's the melding of learning the tools, learning what's possible in work by other poets in your time, and being brave enough to tell your story.
So let's talk about your next mentor.
So before I talk about Ellen Bryant Voigt, I want to say that it goes back to a class I was teaching. So I'm an English teacher at Montpelier High School. This was my last year. And there was a class I wanted to teach that wasn't going to run. There weren't enough students. And I said to the principal, give me 1 week and I will have a creative writing class filled with students. And he said, okay. Within a week, I had 15 students excited to study poetry with me. I was not a publishing poet yet. I just loved it. And so this class ran and the kids were great. They were so smart. They were writing this beautiful work. And I was writing along with them and we were all learning so much. And I was constantly pushing them to do stuff with their work. And they said, well, what about you? What are you doing to push yourself? How are you taking risks? And where are you sending your work, Miss McCadden? And I was like, oh, damn, they got me. So I sent an application to the Breadloaf Writers Conference to see, you know, what happened. So I went to Breadloaf, and the mentor I worked with there was Ellen Bryant Voigt. I had never talked to anybody except David Budbill in private over cups of tea about my poems. And this was a long time since David's work with me. And I had grown a lot and I was working really hard at writing poetry. And so I similarly thought, now I've arrived. Ellen will read my work and she'll think, this is a talented young person. This is great. You know, and I had this fantasy that I would have arrived. And I was looking for someone to rubber stamp me as like, now you are a poet. She was really clear that I had work to do. And I had written work that was pretty derivative of some other poets too. And she was clear about that, but she was willing to work with me. And so I had this poem, but I was terrified, and she's incredibly brilliant. And I just wanted to figure out how to be a poet, you know? So she started working with me at the picnic tables at Breadloaf on this one poem. She's like, I'll work with you on one poem. and I would revise it and bring it back to her. And she'd tell me what I had done and what I could still do. And I'd walk away and I'd do it again. And I just kept working at this one poem during the 10 days I was there and coming back to her. And at the end of the week, she said to me in her beautiful voice, she said, "Now, Karen McCadden, you have written one poem." And just that the validation of being told by Ellen that I had written a poem that worked, right? Even though I had come to this conference hoping that I was a writer of some talent, right? But I was learning sort of the opposite, that I still had, again, so much work to do. She just taught me this indelible lesson about focused work and revision and how do we arrive at a place where a poem is a poem? Like, what does it take? You know, and that's what I learned from her there. And her lesson she taught us about what a poem has to do, what it has to become, where it can't stop, that a poem has to develop something unexpected. And you just can't start and end in the same place. You have to develop something complex and rich.
And so yet there aren't really rules, are there?
No. But there's so many rules. Like, there's no rules, but there's a ton right. of them. It's like, I don't know what it is. It's like a person who builds houses, like a woodworker, has thousands of tools. They all do something, but you have to know which one to use when. This idea of mentorship for me stretches out like a string of pearls. Like, I remember lessons from all the people I've studied with. I studied with Alan Shapiro at Breadloaf after Ellen. I studied with Yvan Boland and just blew my socks off. Marvelous human.
Irish, is she not?
Yeah, she's Irish, yeah. And I wouldn't say I studied with Bridget Pegeen Kelly, but I studied her work and knew her as a person. When she died, I read a poem of hers every night like a prayer. Like, she just is a really powerful figure to me as a person and as a poet. Her work is incredible to me. So her work mentors me. You know, like, that's also possible. And then at Warren Wilson, I studied with C. Dale Young and Rodney Jones and Tony Hoagland and Morris Manning. Just this long, beautiful list of brilliant people who all gave me something important. I love that you're doing this podcast and asking people where they get their inspiration and how, but not just inspiration. That's not what you're asking, actually, is that you're asking who showed you the way, right? And I think that in art, that's really powerful because we need other people and we need people to learn from. And there's a certain generosity inherent in mentorship. And I think it's a beautiful thing to inquire about. So thanks for asking all the questions and stuff.
Well, you're welcome. And don't we know it more than ever how much we need each other?
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah. Aw, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Muse Mentors. You know, we don't charge to listen to this podcast, but that doesn't mean that there aren't real costs associated with it. So how about heading over to musementors.com and lending a hand? You can make a one-time donation or become a Patreon subscriber in any amount. Whether you've contributed before or this is your first time, thank you. Until next time, pick up a poem and read it aloud in the morning when you wake up, or in the evening before you turn out the lights.